It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In 2006, a group of residents in Baltimore's Curtis Bay neighborhood had a problem. Prostitutes stood on street corners waiting for johns. They'd be picked up for prostitution by the police, only to return to the same streets. Citizens formed a task force. What grew out of it was a program rooted in an approach called problem-solving justice. Instead of moving those facing prostitution charges through the criminal justice system, it gives them access to services that might keep them out of it and off the streets. It began in 2009 within the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office and can now serve about 80 people at any given time. Corey Shadema, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, recently co-authored a scholarly article on what she learned during 120 hours of interviews with people who have been through the program. I spoke with her and with Sue Deal, a social worker who's been part of the pretrial diversion program since its beginning. Deal told us that, unlike many diversion programs that require community service, this has one key requirement. The participants have to meet with a social worker.
And that's where I and my colleagues come in, because we will then meet with them on a regular basis. They also meet with their pretrial agent. They also do have a drug assessment.
But when you're meeting with them, what...
What are we doing?
Yeah, what's happening?
We're talking with them about themselves. We're asking them to say, what would you need to do to change things in your life? What do you want to change? How do you want to get to the next level? And what do we have in the city to offer you to help you get there? 90% of the time, they need either mental health or substance abuse treatment, or both. They need a place to sleep that's safe. They need some counseling. They need medical care. And up until very recently, they needed insurance. They need an ID. The people we see are really at the very bottom of have. They got nothing. So the idea is, how do we get them to the resources that they can use? We now are fortunate to have the ability to give them bus passes to get them simple transportation to get from wherever they are to a resource. Because if you can't get there, and sometimes it's a long walk, it's not going to happen.
Professor Shadema, tell us what the profile is of the participants. Who do they tend to be demographically?
So we do know that demographically, at least of the people coming into being arrested for prostitution in Baltimore, we've got about 90% women, about 9% trans women, and 1% men. So in terms of the gender distribution, which was, I would say, somewhat surprising given the task force was pretty much prepared that everyone was going to be women. And so they were somewhat surprised that there was such a large percentage of trans women among the people being arrested for prostitution. The other thing that people are often surprised about is the age of people who are being arrested. So in terms of my sample, we've interviewed people from the ages of 18 to their mid-50s, and the average age for is 34. So often that's older than people think of when they think of people who are being arrested for street-based sex work.
So the people who participate in the diversion program, are they representative of all the people involved in prostitution?
No, that's a great question. What we're looking at, the people who are arrested for prostitution in Baltimore are people who are arrested for street-based prostitution, and they're largely engaged in survival sex work. So they are in prostitution to meet their most basic needs, housing, food, if they have a drug addiction. And so I would be very careful about saying that they're representative. There are many other forms of sex work, including prostitution, where people might be making reasoned choices. They're engaged in either as a career choice, or they're not encountering the same kind of dangers and difficulties that the women who are arrested for this kind of prostitution are.
Do you have a sense of the profile of those who say yes to participating in the program versus those who pass? I mean, is there some identifying characteristics of those who want to do this?
Initially, the thought was that many of these women would not accept the program. It was really a big surprise to find that hardly ever happens.
Well, are they not a fine of up to $500 or up to a year in jail if convicted of prostitution?
However, that's not common. Fines are rarely given because what they do is prostitute to get the money to pay the fine. So a fine is kind of contra. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The jail time is usually cut sufficiently, but they want help. They want to be different. These women are traumatized. They are frequently victims of child sexual abuse. They are suffering from PTSD, not unlike what we hear about from Iraq and Afghanistan. These are people who want something different but have just not got the strength to get there.
And does there tend to be, for the whole group, one service that by and large is the most important in changing things around for them?
Yeah. I would say if they have a good trauma counselor, somebody who can help them work through and work with the trauma that they have experienced. If they can get to that place that they can talk about the trauma that they've experienced, that's not something we can do. That's not something that gets done in 90 days. If we can get them to develop a positive support system, and what we find is that for those that do most often succeed, they do have some support system left, be it a family member, be it a sponsor, be it a neighbor. There is somebody who is a positive influence and still in their life.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Corey Stema, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And also with me is Sue Deal, a social worker who works in the specialized pretrial diversion program in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. Professor Stema, you've written that for nearly all the participants, what was most helpful was being treated by the social workers with compassion and respect. And that was almost more important than the kind of services we've been talking about. Tell me how you know that.
Well, we did interviews with participants who are in the program. So we spoke with 21 people who were participating in the program, five of whom we spoke to twice. I've also done interviews in other settings. So I've spoken to, I'd say, probably about 75 women who are in these types of programs, and it's something that I do hear across the board. And what that says to me is that, in general, women engaged in prostitution are used to being treated poorly. They're used to being treated poorly by social services who, when they seek help or when they're mandated to go to help, they're used to being treated poorly by the criminal justice system. This is almost unanimous that most people noted that when they were treated with dignity, when they were treated, often they use the term being treated as a human being, right? So this is the most pivotal or most important thing to them, is that someone has treated them as a human being. And I think that that says something about the way we treat people overall. So you don't really need to be in a specialized diversion program. It provides some advice about how we could rethink, even for people who are unable to access these programs or for locations where we don't have programs or if people are capped out or ineligible, that one of the things that really makes a difference in their willingness to engage with the program and when they seem to be satisfied with services is being treated with dignity. And that's something that really doesn't cost any money.
The program is envisioned as lasting 90 days for its participant, 90 days to turn their lives around. Many of them have suffered years of abuse and struggled with addiction, and some have health and mental health problems. Sue Deal, about how many of them are able to come out of the program and hold down a job and not reenter the criminal justice system?
Of the people who are in the program, probably 50% do actually succeed in getting to a point that they can be given the NALPROS at the end of the 90 days. Or at some point, we do extensions. If somebody is getting there, but they aren't quite where they want to be yet or where we think they need to be able to say that they have successfully done what they need to do, then we have an opportunity to say, let's extend you for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever.
Now, NALPROS means that the charge against them
can be expunged.
But what constitutes success? I just said job. I don't know whether that's what you all consider success.
No, no. We're not saying job. Job is something that happens very infrequently, but it does happen, thank goodness. But most of these people need so much time to get well before they are employable. They need to be drug-free for a small period of time. They need to be able to get their GED. They need to get their ID. They need to get their... They need so many things that going back to work is is at least 6 months down the road. Now, that does not mean everybody, but there are those who go back to work within that 90 days is a small number. Our job is to get them on the path to employment.
And that's what you call success, if you see they're on a path.
Yes.
One of my interests in this research is finding out from the participants in the program themselves, from the defendants, what do they consider success? And I would say one of the things, particularly from such a short program of 90 days, and you pointed out that often there is a history of problems that they're trying to solve that's much longer than the 90 days, is the idea that they have an address and that they know where to turn to. So if someone can leave the program with the tools to know, okay, if I'm ready for the next step, whether it's finding a job or looking for a house or moving from an inpatient program to an outpatient, I would say that one of our measures of success for these programs should be that they know where to turn and that they know where to turn where people will treat them well and will give them advice that's valuable advice that might help them stay on a path. And many of the respondents that we spoke to in our study, many of the defendants, after they had finished, they really expressed a desire to stay in contact either with Sue or with other people who were in the program. And when we interviewed five of the participants after they had finished, they were indeed still in contact. And I would say that's a measure of success, that you don't, you know, return to the streets if you're in trouble. You have another address.
One of the things that Professor, you spoke with a woman, 34-year-old, named Maria, who told you, quote, "I wish there was more programs that actually was offered without having to go through the courts," close quote. And you raise that question. Why is it necessary to be in a court-controlled program in order to get these services?
Well, I think that a lot of people are either unaware that the services exist. That's one thing that we found. So people were connected to services that prior to their entrance they didn't know. But a lot of times people, even if they're aware, they're unable to access the programs. So there is no one out there who's helping them do all of the things that Sue's been talking about to help them get the ID or get the insurance that would allow them to then receive the mental health services. And so one of the suggestions, and I would agree, I think Maria gave a very astute suggestion. I've heard from other people that I've interviewed, you know, if these services were available to me before, then I might have made a change earlier. And so I think that that's one of the implications of what I'm finding, that it might be beneficial to have some of the services that people need more readily available to them, advertise more to make it easier for people to access the services, and then maybe they would not be in the situation where they're arrested and charged and in the criminal justice system.
I agree, but I also believe that there are resources out there. The Franciscan Center, I mean, our Daily Bread, or the Healthcare for the Homeless. I mean, there are many places that people can go, but they don't, for whatever reason, do that without somebody saying, "Hey, look at yourself. Stop for a minute. Take a look. Let's talk about what you can do. What do you want to do? Do you?" And they will say to me, "I need this, I need that, I need..." They know what they need, but getting that energy together to go and do it. Well, a lot of us know things we need to be doing. We don't get the energy to do it until somebody points out that, hey, you need to wash the windows or you need to do whatever. It's a real life phenomena, and they become... If you're prostituting, your vision of yourself has moved far down the line. You know, the energy is just not there. The trauma history is kicking in big time. They need the support. They need the hug. They need the crackers. They need whatever we do to say, you're worthy. You're worthy. You can look in the mirror and promise that person that you can do better, that you can, you have the power. And that's what we say. You have to incorporate a change to make it happen. And I think that's where the fear, a little bit, there's a fear of going to jail. But many of these people have been to jail. It's not going to be a new phenomenon. We do know if we get you first time, the chances that you succeed are better than if you have been in the business for a while.
So do you see this program continuing as it is? What's the future?
I don't know. Our grant is running out. We have a change in leadership at the coming to the state attorney's office. I don't know where we will be.
We'll check in with you.
We hope.
And I think across the country there is growing interest in these kind of programs. Like I said, there's one existing in Philadelphia. There's a delegation from Delaware that just visited the Philadelphia program. I got a call from New Orleans that they're thinking of looking at it. So I think sometimes the existing resources and political constellation can impact whether a given program exists. But I think overall there's been a growing interest in these kinds of programs. And in thinking a little bit differently about how the criminal justice system responds, both from a perspective of can we be more efficacious, right? Can we do a better job? If our goal is having people desist from prostitution, can we make sure that that works? And I think also from a moral perspective, right? We're a little uncomfortable sometimes. The criminal justice system and the actors in it sometimes are uncomfortable with carrying out the punishments that, as Sue noted, don't really have any impact. So people are doing something that they themselves would prefer not to be doing. And so I think that there's more recognition that it might not make sense to be punishing people for doing something that they would prefer not to do, but rather it's both more efficacious and more ethical to offer them services that
probably less expensive.
And certainly less expensive.
Well, yeah. I appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Corey Shadema is an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Sue Deal is a social worker in the Specialized Pretrial Diversion Program in the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. We've got a link to Professor Shadema's scholarly articles about the diversion program on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too, including the vulnerability of transgender street prostitutes. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, a debut novel about freedom, love, and identity across generations. Stay with us on 88.1.